As we go about our day, we are bombarded with millions of stimuli, a buzzing, blooming confusion of sounds, sights, smells, and motions. And yet, amidst all this pyrotechnic chaos, different parts of the brain and body interact to form an emotional positioning system. Like the global positioning system that might be in your car, the EPS senses your current situation and compares it to the vast body of data it has stored in its memory. It reaches certain judgments about whether the course you are on will produce good or bad outcomes, and then it coats each person, place, or circumstance with an emotion, fear or excitement, admiration or repugnance, and an implied reaction, smile or don't smile, approach or get away, that helps us navigate our days. Let's say someone touches your hand across a restaurant table. Instantly, the mind is searching the memory banks for similar events. Maybe there was a scene in Casablanca when Humphrey Bogart touched Ingrid Bergman's hand. Maybe there was a date in high school long ago. There was a distant memory of Mom reaching across and holding hands with you during a childhood visit to McDonald's. The mind is sorting and coding. The body is responding. The heart speeds, adrenaline rises, a smile opens up. Signals are flowing from body and brain and back again in quick, intricate loops. The brain is not separate from the body. That was Descartes' error. The physical and the mental are connected in complex networks of reaction and counter-reactions, and out of their feedback an emotional value emerges. Already the touch of the hand has been coded with meaning. Something good. Something delicious. An instant later, a different set of loops open. This is the higher set of feedback routes between the evolutionarily older parts of the brain and the newer, more modern parts, such as the prefrontal cortex. This set of information flow is slower but more refined. It can take the reactions that have already been made by the first system and make finer distinctions among them. This hand reaching to touch me across the table is not quite like my mother's hand. It's more like the hand of other people I wanted to have sex with. It can also flash warnings that lead to intelligent restraint. I'm so happy right now I want to pick up this hand and start kissing it, but I've got these other memories of freaking people out when I do things like that. Even through much of this stage, there is still no conscious awareness, argues Joseph Ledoux, another prominent researcher in these vineyards. The touch of the hand has been felt and refelt, sorted and resorted. The body has reacted, plans have been hatched, reactions prepared, and all this complex activity has happened under the surface of awareness and in the blink of an eye. And this process happens not only on a date, with the touch of a hand. It happens at the supermarket when you scan an array of cereal boxes. It happens at the jobs fair when you look over different career options. The emotional positioning system is coating each possibility with emotional value. Eventually, at the end of these complex feedbacks, a desire bursts into consciousness. A desire to choose that cereal, or seek that job, or to squeeze the hand, to touch this person, to be with this person forever. The emotion emerges from the deep. It may not be a brilliant impulse. Emotion sometimes leads us astray, and sometimes leads us wisely. And it doesn't control, it can be overridden, but it propels and guides. As Ledoux writes, the brain states and bodily responses are the fundamental facts of an emotion, and the conscious feelings are the frills that have added icing to the emotional cake. Implications. This understanding of decision-making leads to some essential truths. Reason and emotion are not separate and opposed. Reason is nestled upon emotion and dependent upon it. Emotion assigns value to things, and reason can only make choices on the basis of those valuations. The human mind can be pragmatic because deep down it is romantic. Further, The mind or the self is no one thing. The mind is a blindingly complicated series of parallel processes. There is no captain sitting in a cockpit making decisions. There is no Cartesian theater, a spot where all the different processes and possibilities come together to get ranked and where actions get planned. Instead, as Nobel laureate Gerald Edelman put it, the brain looks like an ecosystem, a fantastically complex associative network of firings, patterns, reactions, and sensations, all communicating with and responding to different parts of the brain, and all competing for a piece of control over the organism. Finally, we are primarily wanderers, not decision makers. Over the past century, people have tended to conceive decision-making as a point in time. You amass the facts and circumstances and evidence, and then make a call. In fact, it is more accurate to say that we are pilgrims in a social landscape. We wander across an environment of people and possibilities. As we wander, the mind makes a near infinite number of value judgments, which accumulate to form goals, ambitions, dreams, desires, and ways of doing things. The key to a well-lived life is to have trained the emotions to send the right signals and to be sensitive to their subtle calls. Rob and Julia were not the best educated people on earth, nor the most profound. But they knew how to love. As they sat at the restaurant, focusing more and more attention on each other, their emotions were sending a rapid stream of guidance signals and shaping whole series of small decisions, and thereby gradually reorienting their lives. All information processing is emotional, notes Kenneth Dodge, in that emotion is the energy that drives, organizes, amplifies, and attenuates cognitive activity, and in turn is the experience and expression of this activity. Rob and Julia were assigning value to each other. They felt themselves swept along in some strong and delightful current that was carrying them towards some place they deliriously wanted to go. This wasn't the sort of dissecting analysis Julia's inner smartass had used when she first glimpsed Rob. This was a powerful, holistic appraisal that followed an entirely different set of rules. Julia would fall in love and then invent reasons for her attraction later. That day, she and Rob began wandering together down a path that would be the most rewarding of their lives. Chapter 2. The Map Meld. Rob and Julia were wonderfully happy in the first few months after their wedding, but they were also engaged, as newlyweds must be, in the map meld. Each of them had come into the marriage with a certain unconscious mental map of how day-to-day life worked. Now that their lives were permanently joined, they were discovering that their maps did not entirely cohere. It was not the big differences they noticed, but the little patterns of existence that they had never even thought of. Julia assumed the dishes should be rinsed and put in the dishwasher as they are soiled. Rob assumed the dishes should be left in the sink for the day and then cleaned all at once in the evening. Julia assumed that toilet paper should roll clockwise so the loose sheets furl out the front. In Rob's house, the toilet paper had always rolled counterclockwise so that the sheets furled out the back. For Rob, reading the morning paper was a solitary activity done in silence by two people who happened to be sitting together. For Julia, the morning paper was a social activity and an occasion for conversation and observations about the state of the world. When Rob went to the grocery store, he bought distinct meal products, a package of tortellini, a frozen pizza, a quiche. When Julia went to the store, she bought ingredients, eggs, sugar, flour. And Rob was amazed that she could spend $200, and when she came back, there was still nothing for dinner. These contrasts did not really bother them, for they were in that early stage of marriage when couples still have time to go running together and have sex afterward. In this mode, they slowly and sensitively negotiated the bargain of their new interdependence. First came the novelty phase, when they were tickled by the interesting new habits each brought into the other's lives. For example, Rob was fascinated by Julia's ferocious attachment to sock wearing. Julia was game for any naked erotic activity he could fantasize about, so long as she was permitted to wear socks while performing it. She could work herself up into a sweaty, panting heat, but apparently blood flow didn't extend to her lower extremities, and if you really wanted to remove those white anklets, it would be like prying a rifle from the president of the NRA. You were going to have to rip them from her cold, dead toes. Julia, meanwhile, had never seen anybody so much in the habit of buying toothpaste during every trip to the drugstore. Rob bought a tube a week, as if Martians were about to invade us for our crest. She was also tickled by his pattern of attention. Rob was intensely interested in any event happening thousands of miles away, especially if it was covered by SportsCenter, but any event directly impinging upon his own emotions and inner state entered the zone of negative interest. He was incapable of focus. Gradually, they entered the second stage of map melding, the stage of pre-campaign planning. A house divided against itself cannot stand. Both Rob and Julia subliminally understood that the quirks that seemed so charming and lovable in the early stages of marriage, Julia's tendency to fire up the laptop in bed at 6 a.m., Rob's feigned laddie helpless in the face of any domestic chore, would cause the other to harbor homicidal urges once the first blush of matrimonial bliss expired. And so they began to make little mental checklists of things that would have to change. But they were sensitive enough not to be Maoist about it. They had somehow absorbed the fact that cultural revolutions lead to angry backlashes or prolonged bursts of passive-aggressive withdrawal, and so reforming the other person's habits would have to be a gradual process. Especially in the first few months, Julia watched Rob the way Jane Goodall watched chimpanzees, with rapt attention and with a sense of constant surprise about the behavior patterns he exhibited. The man had absolutely no interest in artisanal cheeses or any subtle flavors, yet get him within 150 yards of a Brookstone store in the mall, and suddenly he became rapt at the thought of indoor putting greens with automatic ball return. He considered himself a neat man, but neatness for him consisted of taking everything that had been cluttering the countertops and shoving them willy-nilly in the nearest available drawers. He never laid out the pieces he would need in preparation for some assembly project. He simply dove right into the project and spent hours in the middle of it trying to figure out where everything was. He was apparently smarter than every football coach he had ever watched, but lacked the foresight to see that leaving your shoes in the path that leads from the bed to the bathroom might create problems in the middle of the night. Then there was the night of the movie ticket. One night, Rob was walking home from work, and he walked past a theater that had seats available for a film he had wanted to see. He bought a ticket impromptu, as he had done many times during his bachelorhood, and called Julia to let her know that he'd texted some buddies to join him and that he'd be home late that night. He called in a happy, haphazard mood, and was utterly stunned when he sensed that the temperature on the other end of the call had dropped 200 degrees. He could hear Julia doing the sort of breathing exercises one does when one is trying to restrain an impulse to put an axe in another person's head. It soon became clear that, in fact, he would not be going to the movies that night. It became clear that these sorts of spontaneous larks would no longer be a regular feature of his life, and that marriage was not simply an extended phase of boyhood, but with serving dishes and regular sex. Rob was made to understand in phrases, interrupted by long glacial pauses, of the sort one uses when trying to explain something to a particularly stupid preschooler, that life from now on was going to involve a different level of commitment and joint planning, and that a certain sort of carefree, "what do I want for myself at this moment," thinking, would have to go. Once this unconscious paradigm shift occurred in Rob's head, the relationship progressed relatively smoothly. Both issued their own domestic Monroe doctrines, parts of their lives that they considered sacred, and where external meddling would be regarded as an act of war. Both were pleased by the loving acts of compromise each made on behalf of the other. Rob admired his own selfless nobility every time he remembered to put the toilet seat down. Julia silently compared herself to Mother Teresa every time she pretended to enjoy action movies. And so commenced the division of marital labor. Both gravitated to areas of superior passion. For example, Rob somehow took control of all vacation planning, because he secretly considered himself the Robert E. Lee of the travel excursion, the brilliant tactician who could rise to any canceled flight, airport snafu, or hotel screw-up. This meant Julia had to endure his Bataan Death March vacation schedule, 6 vineyards before lunch. But to her that was better than sitting down with a travel agent and going through hotel reservations. Julia, meanwhile, took over all aspects of the material surroundings. If Rob was unwilling to engage in discerning commentary during their trips to funky yet casual furniture stores, he could hardly expect to render the final judgments when the purchase decisions had to be made. Marital satisfaction generally follows a U-shaped curve. Couples are deliriously happy during the first years of marriage. Their self-reported satisfaction declines and bottoms out when their children hit adolescence. Then it climbs again as they enter retirement. Newlywed, Rob and Julia were indeed phenomenally happy and quite well suited for each other. And on most days, they had sex. Procreation. One day, about 6 months after their wedding, Julia and Rob woke up late and had brunch at a neighborhood place with country furniture and distressed wooden tables. Then they went shopping and grabbed sandwiches, which they ate on a bench in the park. They were alive to sensations of all sorts. The way the bread felt in their hands, the feel of stones they tossed into a pond. Julia absent-mindedly watched Rob's hands as he used a little plastic knife to spread mustard across his sandwich. Her conscious thoughts were on the story she was telling him, but unconsciously she was becoming aroused. Rob was listening to her tale, but without even thinking about it, he was looking at a soft, small crease in the skin of her neck. In the back of his mind, he was ready to have sex right then and there, if a conveniently sized bush could be found. People used to argue that men and women had the same desire for sex, but on average, that's not true. Male desire is pretty steady and only dips in response to some invisible awareness of their partner's menstrual cycles. Studies in strip clubs have found that dancers' tips plunge 45% while they are menstruating, though the explanation for the drop is not clear. That particular day in the park, Rob wanted Julia with all his body and all his soul. This wasn't merely a Darwinian reflex. Rob had all sorts of internal barriers that made it hard for him to express his emotions. His feelings were there, but they were hidden somewhere inside in a place where he couldn't easily grasp or understand them. Even in those moments when he did have a sense of what he was feeling, the words wouldn't come to help him express it. But during sex, his internal communication barriers dissolved. In the throes of passion, he went into a mental fog. He was no longer aware of his surroundings or how he might be perceived. His emotions for Julia surfaced with their full force. He could feel his own emotions directly and express them unselfconsciously. The quickie acts of copulation that Julia sometimes granted him as a favor didn't really do this for him. But when they were both in the throes of passion together, Rob experienced the bliss of unencumbered communication that was the real object of his longing. There's something to the old joke that women need to feel loved in order to have sex, and men need to have sex in order to feel loved. Julia's desire was even more complicated. It was like a river with many tributaries. Like most women, Julia's interest in sex was influenced by how much testosterone her body produced at any given moment, and by how she processed serotonin. It was influenced by the busyness of her day, her general mood, and the conversations she'd had with friends at lunch. It was influenced by images and sensations she wasn't even aware of. The sight of a piece of art, a melody, a field of flowers. Julia enjoyed looking at male bodies, female bodies, or anything in between. Like most women, she got lubricated even while looking at nature's shows of animals copulating, even though consciously the thought of being aroused by animals was repellent. Julia's sexual tastes were more influenced by culture than Rob's. Men want to do the same sexual acts regardless of education levels, but female sexual preferences differ by education, culture, and status level. Highly educated women are much more likely to perform oral sex, engage in same-sex activity, and experiment with a variety of other activities than less educated women. Religious women are less adventurous than non-religious women, though the desires of religious men are not much different than those of secular ones. They say that foreplay for a woman is anything that happens 24 hours before intercourse. That evening, they watched a movie, had a drink, and before long they were playfully, then passionately, making love, heading toward the usual climax. An orgasm is not a reflex. It's a perception, a mental event. It starts with a cascade of ever more intense physical and mental feedback loops. Touches and sensations release chemicals like dopamine and oxytocin, which in turn generate even more sensory input, culminating in a complex and explosive light show in the brain. Some women can achieve orgasms just by thinking the right thoughts. Some women with spinal cord injuries can achieve orgasm through the stimulation of their ears. Others can achieve orgasms through stimulation of the genitals that, because of a paralyzing accident, they are supposedly unable to feel. A woman in Taiwan could experience temporal lobe seizures and shattering orgasms merely by brushing her teeth. A man studied by V.S. Ramachandran at UC San Diego felt orgasms in his phantom foot. His foot had been amputated, and the brain region corresponding to the foot had nothing to do. Since the brain is plastic and adaptive, sensations from the penis spread into the vacant real estate, and the man felt his subsequent orgasms in a foot that didn't exist. As they made love, Rob and Julia sent rhythmic vibrations through their minds and bodies. Julia had the mental traits that are associated with ease of orgasms, a willingness to surrender mental control, the ability to be hypnotized, the inability to control thoughts during sex, and she felt herself once again heading in the right direction. A few minutes later, their frontal cortexes partially shut down, while their senses of touch became ever more acute. They lost all remaining self-consciousness, any sense of time or where each other's bodies ended and theirs began. Sight became a series of abstract patches of color. The result was a pair of satisfying climaxes, and eventually, through the magic of the birds and the bees, a sun. Chapter 3. Mind Sight. It is sad to report that even in her late 20s, Julia kept her spring break personality alive and on call. Responsible and ambitious by day, she would let her inner Cosmo girl out for a romp on Saturday nights. In these moods, she still thought it was cool to be sassy. She still thought it was a sign of social bravery to be a crude-talking, hard-partying, cotton-candy lipstick-wearing, thong-snapping, balls-to-the-wall disciple in the church of Lady Gaga. She still thought she was taking control of her sexuality by showing cleavage. She thought the barbed wire tat around her thigh was a sign of body confidence. She was excellent entertainment at parties, always first in line for drinking games and bi-curious female kissing. Ensconced in late-night throngs of group inebriation, she would walk perilously close to the line of skankdom without ever quite going over. Up until well into her pregnancy, it is fair to say that a truly maternal thought never crossed her mind. Harold, who was just forming in her womb at this point, was going to have to work if he was going to turn her into the sort of mother he deserved. He began that work early and hard. As a fetus, Harold grew 250,000 brain cells every minute, and he had well over 20 billion of them by the time he was born. Soon his taste buds began to work, and he could tell when the amniotic fluid surrounding him turned sweet or garlicky, depending upon what his mother had for lunch. Fetuses swallow more of the fluid when sweetener is added. By 17 weeks, he was feeling his way around the womb. He began touching his umbilical cord and pressing his fingers together. By then, he was also developing greater sensitivity to the world beyond. A fetus will withdraw from pain at 5 months. If somebody were to direct a bright flashlight directly at Julia's belly, Harold could sense the light and move away. By the third trimester, Harold was dreaming, or at least making the same sorts of eye movements that adults make when they dream. It was at this point that the real work of Operation Motherhood could begin. Harold was still a fetus, with barely any of the features of what we would call consciousness, but already he was listening and memorizing the tone of his mother's voice. After birth, babies will suck hard on a nipple in order to hear a recording of their mother's voice, and much less hard to hear a recording of another woman's voice. He wasn't only listening to tones, but also to the rhythms and patterns he would need to understand and communicate. French babies cry differently than babies who have heard German in the womb, because they've absorbed the French lilt of their mother's voices. Anthony J. DeCasper and others at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro had some mothers read The Cat in the Hat to their fetuses over a period of weeks. The fetuses remembered the tonal pattern of the story, and after they were born, they'd suck more calmly and rhythmically on a pacifier than when they heard another story in a different meter. Harold spent his 9 months in the womb growing and developing, and then one fine day, he was born. This wasn't a particularly important event as far as his cognitive development was concerned, though he had a much better view. Now he could get to work on his mother in earnest, eliminating Julia the party girl and creating Supermom Julia. First, he would have to build a set of bonds between them that would supersede all others. A few minutes old, wrapped in a blanket and lying on his mother's chest, Harold was already a little bonding machine, and had a repertoire of skills to help him connect with those he loved. In 1981, Andrew Meltzoff ushered in a new era of infant psychology when he stuck his tongue out at a 42-minute-old infant. The baby stuck her tongue out back at him. It was as if the baby, who had never seen a tongue in her life, intuited that the strange collection of shapes in front of her was a face, that the little thing in the middle of it was a tongue, that there was a creature behind the face, that the tongue was something other than herself, and that she herself had a corresponding little flap that she too could move around. The experiment has been replicated with babies at different ages, and since then researchers have gone off in search of other infant abilities. They've found them. People once believed that babies were blank slates, but the more investigators look, the more impressed they have become with how much babies know at birth, and how much they learn in the first few months after. The truth is, starting even before we are born, we inherit a great river of knowledge, a great flow of patterns coming from many ages and many sources. The information that comes from deep in the evolutionary past we call genetics. The information revealed thousands of years ago we call religion. The information passed along from hundreds of years ago we call culture. The information passed along from decades ago we call family. And the information offered years, months, days, or hours ago we call education and advice. But it is all information, and it all flows from the dead through us and to the unborn. The brain is adapted to the river of knowledge and its many currents and tributaries, and it exists as a creature of that river, the way a trout exists in a stream. Our thoughts are profoundly molded by this long historic flow, and none of us exists self-made in isolation from it. So even a newborn possesses this rich legacy and is built to absorb more and to contribute back to this long current. Though he still had no awareness of himself as a separate person, little Harold had a repertoire of skills to get Julia to fall in love with him. The first was his appearance. Harold had all the physical features that naturally attract a mother's love: big eyes, a large forehead, a small mouth and chin. These features arouse deep responses in all humans, whether they are on babies or Mickey Mouse or E.T. He also had the ability to gaze. Harold would lie next to Julia and stare at her face. After a few months, he developed a seductive sense of timing, when to look to attract Julia's gaze, when to turn away, and then when to look back to attract her again. He would stare at her and she would gaze back. At an amazingly early age, he could pick out his mother's face from a gallery of faces and stare at it longer. He could tell the difference between a happy face and a sad face. He became extremely good at reading faces, at noting tiny differences in muscular movements around the eyes and mouth. For example, 6-month-old babies can spot the different facial features of different monkeys, even though, to adults, they all look the same. Then there was touch. Harold felt a primeval longing to touch his mother as much and as often as possible. As Harry Harlow's famous monkey experiments suggest, babies will forego food in exchange for skin or even a towel that feels soft and nurturing. They'll do it because physical contact is just as important as nourishment for their neural growth and survival. This kind of contact was also a life-altering deliciousness for Julia. Human skin has 2 types of receptors. 1 type transmits information to the somatosensory cortex for the identification and manipulation of objects, but the other type activates the social parts of the brain. It's a form of body-to-body communication that sets off hormonal and chemical cascades, lowering blood pressure and delivering a sense of transcendent well-being. Harold would lie there on Julia's chest, suckling at her nipple, forging a set of intimate connections that stimulated the growing cells in his brain. Julia would find herself suffused with a deep sense of fulfillment that she had never imagined before. Once she actually caught herself wondering, "What do I need sex for? This is so much more satisfying." This came from the woman who was voted most likely to appear in a Girls Gone Wild video while in college. Then, and maybe most powerfully, there was smell. Harold just smelled wonderful. The subtle odor that arose from his hot little head penetrated deep into Julia's being, creating a sense of connection she had never imagined before. Finally, there was rhythm. Harold began imitating Julia. Just a few months old, Harold would open his mouth when Julia opened hers. He'd move his head from side to side when she moved her head from side to side. Soon he could copy hand gestures. In looking into Julia's eyes, in touching her skin, in mimicking her gestures, Harold was starting a proto-conversation, an unconscious volley of emotions, moods, and responses. Julia found herself playing along, staring into his eyes, getting him to open his mouth, getting him to shake his head. Not long ago, a psychology class took advantage of the human capacity for this sort of proto-conversation to play a trick on their professor. The class decided beforehand that they would look at him attentively when he lectured from the left side of the room, but look away or appear distracted when he wandered over to the right side. As the class went on, the professor unconsciously stood more and more on the left side of the room. By the end, he was practically out the door. He had no idea what his students were doing, but he just felt better from that side of his room. His behavior was pulled by this invisible social gravity. Of course, Julia and Harold's proto-conversation was much deeper. Harold kept up Operation Motherhood with steady and relentless persistence, week after week, month after month, breaking down her barriers, rewiring her personality, insinuating himself in her every thought and feeling, gradually transforming her very identity. The invasion. Julia's old personality battled back. You have to give her credit for that. She didn't just surrender to this new creature without a struggle. For most of the first year, Julia would breastfeed Harold from a chair in the corner of his room. At her baby shower, her friends, very few of whom had babies themselves, gave her the sorts of things they considered essential for successful nurturing. She had the audio and video baby monitors, the air purifier, the baby Einstein mobiles, the dehumidifier, the electronic photo displays, the visually stimulating floor mat, the rattles for manual dexterity, and the orally soothing ocean currents noise machine. She would sit there amidst all the gizmos, breastfeeding him, looking like a milkmaid Captain Kirk in the chair of the Starship Enterprise. One night, about 7 months into Harold's life, Julia was in the chair with Harold at her breast. The nightlight glowed softly and everything was quiet all around. It looked superficially like an idyllic maternal scene, a mother suckling her child, all filled with love and sweet affections. But if you could have read Julia's mind at that moment, here's what you would have found her saying. Fuck! 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 Help me! Help me! Will somebody please help me? At this moment, tired, oppressed, violated, she hated the little bastard. He'd entered her mind with tricks of sweet seduction. And once inside, he'd stomped over everything with the infant equivalent of jackboots. He was half Cupid, half stormtrooper. The greedy asshole wanted everything. Harold controlled the hours of her sleep, the span of her attention, the time she could shower, rest, or go to the bathroom. He controlled what she thought, how she looked, whether she cried. Julia was miserable and overwhelmed. The average baby demands adult attention of one kind or another every 20 seconds. New mothers lose an average of 700 hours of sleep during that first year. Marital satisfaction plummets 70%, while the risk of maternal depression more than doubles. At the merest hint of discomfort, Harold could let out a piercing scream that could leave Julia weeping in hysterics and Rob angry and miserable. Exhausted, Julia would sit there in the chair, breastfeeding her little boy while thinking of the fat vessel she had become. Her thoughts raced through dark forests. She realized she would never again look as good in tight skirts. She'd never do anything on a whim. Instead, she'd get sucked into the vapid attitudes of the bourgeois mommy wars. She'd already come into contact with the pious breastfeeding crusaders, the uber-boobers, the self-righteous playdate queens who would correct her parenting techniques, the sanctimommies, and the mopey martyr mommies who would bitch on endlessly about how rotten their lives were and how inconsiderate their husbands and parents had become. She'd get involved in those numbingly dull playground conversations, and, as Jill Lepore once noted, they'd be all the same. The mothers would all want forgiveness, and the fathers would all want applause. She could say farewell to the party-going life that gave her such pleasure. Instead, Julia saw a grim future spreading out before her. School lunches, recycling sermons, strep tests, ear infections, and hours spent praying for nap time. To top it all off, women who give birth to boys have shorter life expectancies because the boys' testosterone can compromise their immune system. Intertwined. Then, maybe a second after this anger and depression had flashed across her mind, Julia would lean back into the chair and hold Harold's head up to her nose. Then Harold would lie on her chest, grab her pinky with his little hand, and start suckling again. Little tears of joy and gratitude would well up in her eyes. Kenneth Kay has suggested that human infants are the only mammalian infants who nurse in bursts, sucking for a few seconds, then pausing while the nipple is still in the mouth, and then resuming for another round. This pause, Kay theorizes, induces the mother to jiggle her baby. When the baby is 2 days old, mothers jiggle for about 3 seconds. When the baby is a few weeks old, the jiggle is down to 2. These movements sent Julia and Harold into a sort of ballet with its own rhythm. Harold paused, Julia jiggled. Harold paused, Julia jiggled. It was a conversation. As Harold aged, this rhythm would continue. He'd look at her, and she'd look at him. Their world was structured by dialogue. It's almost musical the way the rhythm between mother and child evolves. Julia, no natural vocalist, found herself singing to him at the oddest moments, mostly, for some reason, songs from West Side Story. She read the Wall Street Journal to him in the morning and amused herself by reading every story that had to do with the Federal Reserve Board in Motherese, the slow, exaggerated, sing-song intonation that mothers in all cultures across the world use when speaking to their young. Sometimes, as the months went by, she would begin impersonator training. She would mold her face into some expression and then get Harold to mimic until he looked like some celebrity. By scowling, she could get him to look like Mussolini. By growling, Churchill. By opening her mouth and looking scared, Jerry Lewis. Sometimes when he smiled, it was actually disconcerting. He gave a knowing, devious smile like some fraternity scuzzball who'd put a hidden camera in her shower. Harold was so desperate to bond that, if the tempo of their conversation was interrupted, his whole world could fall to pieces. Scientists conduct a type of experiment they call still face research. They ask a mother to interrupt her interactions with her child and adopt a blank, passive expression. Babies find this extremely disconcerting. They tense, cry, and fuss. Babies make a strenuous effort to regain their mother's attention, and if there is still no response, they too become passive and withdrawn. That's because babies organize their internal states by seeing their own minds reflected back at them in the faces of others. Except when Julia was completely exhausted, their conversations went on like a symphony. Harold's energy was regulated by her energy. His brain was built by her brain. By the 9th month, Harold still had no sense of self-awareness. He was still limited in so many ways. But he had done what he needed to do to survive and flourish. He had intertwined his mind with the mind of another. Out of this relationship, his own faculties would grow. It's tempting to think that people grow like plants. You add nourishment to the seed, and an individual plant grows up. But that's not so. Mammal brains grow properly only when they are able to interpenetrate with another. Rat pups, who are licked and groomed by their mothers, have more synaptic connections than rat pups who aren't. Rats who are separated from their mothers for 24 hours lose twice as many brain cells in the cerebral and cerebellar cortices than rats who are not separated. Rats raised in interesting environments have 25% more synapses than those raised in ordinary cages. Though some mysterious emotional outpourings produce physical changes. Back in the 1930s, H.M. Scheels studied mentally disabled orphans who were living in an institution but were subsequently adopted. After 4 years, their IQs diverged an amazing 50 points from those of the orphans who were not adopted. And the remarkable thing is that the kids who were adopted were not improved by tutoring and lecturing. The mothers who adopted them were also mentally disabled and living in a different institution. It was the mother's love and attention that produced the IQ spike. By now, Harold's face lit up when Julia entered the room. This was good, because Julia was coming apart at the seams. She hadn't slept well in months. She once considered herself relatively tidy, but now her house looked like a corner of Rome after a visit from the barbarian hordes. Franklin Roosevelt was able to launch the New Deal in the amount of time that had passed since her last witty observation. But in the mornings, Harold let out a big smile, and he got to live another day. One morning, it dawned on Julia that she knew Harold better than any other person on earth. She knew the ways in which he needed her. She knew his difficulty in making transitions from one setting to another. She sensed, sadly, that he seemed to long for some sort of connection from her that she would never be able to offer. Yet they had never actually exchanged a word of conversation. Harold didn't talk. They got to know each other largely through touch, tears, looks, smell, and laughter. Julia had always assumed that meanings and concepts came through language, but now she realized that it was possible to have a complex human relationship without words. Mirror neurons. Philosophers have long argued about the process people use to understand one another. Some believe that we are careful theorizers. We come up with hypotheses about how other people will behave and then test those hypotheses against the evidence we observe minute by minute. In this theory, people come across as rational scientists, constantly weighing evidence and testing explanations. And there's clear evidence that this sort of hypothesis testing is part of how we understand one another. But these days, most of the research points to the primacy of a rival hypothesis, that we automatically simulate others and understand what others feel by feeling a version of what they are experiencing in ourselves. In this view, people aren't cold theorizers who are making judgments about other creatures. They are unconscious method actors who understand by sharing or at least simulating the responses they see in the people around them. We're able to function in a social world because we partially permeate each other's minds and understand. Some people more, some people less. Human beings understand others in themselves, and they form themselves by reenacting the internal processes they pick up from others. In 1992, researchers at the University of Parma in Italy were studying the brains of macaque monkeys when they noticed a strange phenomenon. When a monkey saw a human researcher grab a peanut and bring it to his mouth, the monkey's brain would fire just as if the monkey were itself grabbing a peanut and bringing it to its own mouth, even though the monkey wasn't actually moving at all. The monkey was automatically simulating the mental processes it observed in another. So was born the theory of mirror neurons, the idea that we have in our heads neurons that automatically recreate the mental patterns of those around us. Mirror neurons are not physically different from any other sort of neuron. It's the way the former are connected that seems to enable them to perform this remarkable task of deep imitation. Over the last few years, mirror neurons have become one of the most hyped and debated issues in all of neuroscience. Some scientists believe mirror neurons are akin to DNA and will revolutionize our understanding of how people internally process outer experiences, how we learn from and communicate with others. Others think the whole idea is vastly overblown. They are quick to point out that the phrase mirror neurons is patently misleading because it suggests the mimicking skill is contained in the neurons, not in the networks in the brain. But there does seem to be a widely held view that monkey and human brains have an automatic ability to perform deep imitation, and in this way share mental processes across the invisible space between them. As Marco Iacoboni has observed, people are able to feel what others experience as if it were happening to them. The monkeys in Parma not only mimicked the actions they observed, they seemed to unconsciously evaluate the intentions behind them. Their neurons fired intensely when a glass was picked up in a context that suggested drinking, but they did not fire the same way when an empty glass was picked up in a context that suggested cleaning up. The monkeys' brains would not fire when scientists merely pantomimed picking up a raisin, but they did fire when the scientists picked up a real raisin. Their neurons fired in a certain characteristic pattern when they saw a scientist tearing a piece of paper, but they also fired in that same pattern when they merely heard a scientist tearing paper. In other words, these weren't mere monkey-see-monkey-do imitations of physical actions. The way the brains reacted to an action was inextricably linked to the goal implied by the action. We sometimes assume that the mental process of perceiving an action is distinct from the mental process of evaluating an action. But in these examples, the processes of perception and evaluation are all intermingled. They share the same representational systems, the same network patterns in the brain. Since those original experiments in Italy, many scientists, including Iacoboni, believe they have found mirror neurons in humans. Human mirror neurons help people interpret the intention of an action, although unlike monkey mirror neurons, they seem to be able to imitate an action even when no goal is detected. A woman's brain will respond with a certain pattern as she watches a person use two fingers to pick up a wine glass, but her brain will respond in a different way as she watches a person use two fingers and the same action to pick up a toothbrush. Her brain will respond one way when it watches another human in the act of speaking, but a different way when it watches a monkey in the act of chattering. When people watch a chase scene in a movie, they respond as if they were actually being chased, except at lower intensity. When they look at pornography, their brains respond as if they were actually having sex, except at lower intensity. When Harold watched Julia look down lovingly at him, he presumably reenacted the activity in her brain and learned how love feels and works from the inside. Harold would grow up to be a promiscuous imitator, and this helped him in all sorts of ways. Carol Eckerman, a psychology professor at Duke, has conducted research suggesting that the more a child plays imitation games, the more likely it is that the child will become an early fluent speaker. Tanya Chartrand and John Barge found that the more two people imitate each other's movements, the more they like each other, and the more they like each other, the more they imitate. Many scientists believe that the ability to unconsciously share another's pain is a building block of empathy, and through that emotion, morality. However the science on mirror neurons eventually shakes out, the theory gives us a vehicle to explain a phenomenon we see every day, and never as much as in the relationship between parents and child. Minds are intensely permeable. Loops exist between brains. The same thought and feeling can arise in different minds, with invisible networks filling the space between them. Make 'em laugh. One day, months and months later, Julia, Rob, and Harold were sitting around the table at dinner when Rob, absent-mindedly, dropped a tennis ball on the table. Harold exploded in peals of laughter. Rob dropped it again. Harold's mouth opened wide. His eyes crinkled. His body quaked. A little bump of tissue rose between his eyebrows, and the sound of rapturous laughter filled the room. Rob held the ball above the table, and they all sat there frozen in anticipation. Then he let it bounce a few times, and Harold exploded with glee, even louder than before. He sat there in his pajamas, his tiny hands oddly still, transported by laughter. Rob and Julia had tears coming out of their eyes. They were laughing so hard along with him. Rob kept doing it over and over. Harold would stare in anticipation of the ball being dropped and then let rip with squeals of delight when he saw it bounce, his head bobbing, his tongue trembling, his eyes moving delightedly from face to face. Rob and Julia matched him squeal for squeal, their voices blending and modulating with his. These were the best moments of their days, the little games of peekaboo, the wrestling and tickling on the floor, Sometimes Julia would hold a little washcloth in her mouth over the changing table, and Harold would grab it and hilariously try to cram it back in. It was the repetition of predictable surprise that sent Harold into ecstasy. The games gave him a sense of mastery, that he was beginning to understand the patterns of the world. They gave him that sensation, which is something like pure joy for babies, a feeling in perfect synchronicity with Mom and Dad. Laughter exists for a reason, and it probably existed before humans developed language. Robert Provine of the University of Maryland has found that people are 30 times more likely to laugh when they are with other people than when they are alone. When people are in bonding situations, laughter flows. Surprisingly, people who are speaking are 46% more likely to laugh during conversation than people who are listening. And they're not exactly laughing at hilarious punchlines. Only 15% of the sentences that trigger laughter are funny in any discernible way. Instead, laughter seems to bubble up spontaneously amidst conversation when people feel themselves responding in parallel ways to the same emotionally positive circumstances. Some jokes, like puns, are asocial and are often relished by those suffering from autism. But most jokes are intensely social and bubble up when people find a solution to some social incongruity. Laughter is a language that people use to bond, to cover over social awkwardness, or to reinforce bonding that has already occurred. This can be good, as when a crowd laughs together, or bad, as when a crowd ridicules a victim. But laughter and solidarity go together. As Stephen Johnson has written, laughing is not an instinctive physical response to humor, the way a flinch responds to pain or a shiver to cold. It's an instinctive form of social bonding that humor is crafted to exploit. Night after night, Harold and his parents would try to fall into rhythm with one another. Sometimes they failed. Rob and Julia would be unable to get inside Harold's mind and figure out what he needed to soothe his agony. Sometimes they succeeded. And when they did, laughter was the reward. If you had to step back and ask where Harold came from, you could give a biological answer and explain conception and pregnancy and birth. But if you really wanted to explain where the essence of Harold, or the essence of any person, came from, you would have to say that first there was a relationship between Harold and his parents. And that relationship had certain qualities. And then, as Harold matured and developed self-consciousness, those qualities became individualized and came to exist in him even when he was apart from his parents. That is to say, people don't develop first and create relationships. People are born into relationships with parents, with ancestors, and those relationships create people. Or, to put it a different way, a brain is something that is contained within a single skull. A mind only exists within a network. It is the result of the interaction between brains, and it is important not to confuse brains with minds. As Samuel Taylor Coleridge once observed, "Ere yet a conscious self exists, the love begins, and the first love is love of another. The babe acknowledges a self in the mother's form years before it can recognize a self in its own." Coleridge described how his own child, then 3 years old, awoke during the night and called out to his mother, "Touch me, only touch me with your finger," the young boy pleaded. The child's mother was astonished. "Why?" she asked. "I'm not here," the boy cried. "Touch me, mother, so that I may be here." Chapter 4. Map Making. Harold had begun his life staring at Mom, but it wasn't long before the grubby world of materialism entered the picture. He didn't begin this phase longing for Porsches and Rolexes. At first he was more of a stripes man. Stripes and black and white checkered squares. After that he developed a thing for edges. Edges of boxes, edges of shelves. He would stare at edges the way Charles Manson stared at cops. Then, as the months went by, it was boxes, wheels, rattles, and sippy cups. He became a great leveler, consumed by the conviction that all matter should rest at its lowest possible altitude. Plates came off tables and onto the floor. Books came off shelves and onto the floor. Half-used boxes of spaghettini were liberated from their pantry prison and returned to their natural habitat across the kitchen floor. The delightful thing about Harold at this stage was that he was both a psychology major and a physics major. His two main vocations were figuring out how to learn from his mother and figuring out how stuff falls. He'd look at her frequently to make sure she was protecting him, and then go off in search of stuff to topple. He possessed what Alison Gopnik, Andrew Meltzoff, and Patricia Kuhl call an explanatory drive. Harold could sit for long stretches trying to fit different-sized boxes inside one another, and then when they were finally together, some primeval Sandy Koufax urge would come over him, and they'd be flying down the stairs. He was exploring and learning, but at this point in his life, Harold's thought processes were radically different from yours and mine. Young children don't seem to have a self-conscious inner observer. The executive function areas in the front of the brain are slow to mature, so Harold did little controlled, self-directed thinking. That meant he had no inner narrator that he thought of as himself. He couldn't consciously remember the past or consciously connect his past actions to his present ones in one coherent timeline. He couldn't remember earlier thoughts or how he learned anything. Until he was 18 months, he couldn't pass the mirror test. If you put a sticker on an adult chimpanzee's forehead or a dolphin's forehead, the animal understands that the sticker is on his own head. But Harold lacked that amount of self-awareness. To him, the sticker was on the forehead of some creature in the mirror. He was very good at recognizing others, but he could not recognize himself. Even up to age 3, children don't seem to get the concept of self-consciously focused attention. They assume that the mind goes blank when there is no outside thing bidding for its attention. When you ask preschoolers if an adult they are watching is focusing her attention on part of a scene, they don't seem to understand what you were talking about. If you ask them if they can go long stretches of time without thinking at all, they say yes. As Alison Gopnik writes in The Philosophical Baby, they don't understand that thoughts can simply follow the logic of your internal experience instead of being triggered from the outside. Gopnik writes that adults have searchlight consciousness. We direct attention at specific locations. Harold, like all young children, had what Gopnik calls lantern consciousness. It illuminated outward in all directions, a vivid panoramic awareness of everything. It was like being exuberantly lost in a 360-degree movie. A million things caught his attention in random bombardments. Here was an interesting shape. There was another. There was a light. There was a person. Even that description understates the radical weirdness of Harold's consciousness at this point. The lantern metaphor suggests that Harold is illuminating and observing the world, and that the observer is somehow separate from what he sees. But Harold wasn't observing. He was immersing. He was vividly participating in whatever came across his mind. The task. At this point in his life, Harold had to learn the most, the fastest. His job was to figure out what sort of environment he lived in and carve mental maps that would help him navigate it. Conscious, directed learning couldn't help him perform this task quickly, but unconscious immersion could. Much of childhood, much of life, consists of integrating the chaotic billions of stimuli we encounter into sophisticated models, which are then used to anticipate, interpret, and navigate through life. As John Bowlby wrote, "Every situation we meet with in life is construed in terms of the representational models we have of the world about us and of ourselves. Information reaching us through our sense organs is selected and interpreted in terms of those models. Its significance for us and for those we care for is evaluated in terms of them, and plans of action conceived and executed with those models in mind. Those internal maps determine how we see, what emotional value we assign to things, what we want, how we react, and how good we are at predicting what will come next." Harold was in his most intense period of map-making. Elizabeth Spelke believes babies are born with a core knowledge of the world, which gives them a head start with this task. Infants know a rolling ball should keep rolling, and that if it rolls behind something, it should come out the other side. At 6 months, they can tell the difference between 8 and 16 dots on a page. They have a sense of mathematical proportion, though they obviously don't know how to count. Before long, they are performing impressive acts of decoding. Meltzoff and Kuhl showed 5-month-old babies silent videos of a face saying either "ah" or "e," and then played the baby's audio tapes of each sound. The babies could correctly match the sound to the right face. If you read an 8-month-old baby a phrase like "la-ta-ta" or "mi-na-na," within 2 minutes the baby will pick up the underlying rhyme scheme, ABB. Young children also use a phenomenally sophisticated statistical technique to understand language. When adults speak, all the sounds of the different words run together. But young children are able to discern that there is a high probability that the sound pre should go with the sound t. So pretty is one word. There is a high probability that bay will also go with b. So baby is one word. Children can do these sorts of complex probability calculations even though their conscious capacities are barely online. Only connect. Harold's brain had over 100 billion cells or neurons in it. As Harold began making sense of the world, each of these neurons sent out branches to make connections with other neurons. The space where two branches for different neurons meet is called a synapse. Harold was making these connections at a furious pace. Some scientists calculate that humans create 1.8 million synapses per second from their second month in utero to their second birthday. The brain makes synapses to store information. Each thing we know is embodied in a network of neural connections. By age 2 or 3, each of Harold's neurons could have made an average of about 15,000 connections, though the unused ones will get pruned back. Harold could end up with something in the neighborhood of 100 trillion, or 500 trillion, or even 1,000 trillion synapses. If you want to get a sense of the number of potential connections between the cells in Harold's brain, contemplate this. A mere 60 neurons are capable of making 10 to the 81st power possible connections with each other. That's 1, with 81 zeros after it. The number of particles in the known universe is about 1/10 of this number. Jeff Hawkins suggests a different way to think about the brain. Imagine a football stadium filled with spaghetti. Now imagine it shrunk down to skull size and much more complicated. In their book, The Scientist in the Crib, Gopnik, Meltzoff, and Kuhl have a nice description of the process neurons use to connect with one another. It's as if, when you used your cell phone to call your neighbor often enough, a cable spontaneously grew between your houses. At first, cells exuberantly attempt to connect to as many other cells as they can. Like phone solicitors, they call everyone, hoping someone will answer and say yes. When another cell does answer, and answers enough, a more permanent link gets laid down. I want to pause here, because this process of synaptogenesis is part of the core of who Harold was. For millennia, philosophers have sought a definition of the human self. What is it that makes a person ineffably herself, despite the changes that happen day by day and year by year? What is it that unifies all the different thoughts, actions, and emotions that pass through each of our lives? Where does the true self lie? A piece of the answer lies in the pattern of synaptic connections. When we come across an apple, our sensory perceptions about that apple, its color, shape, texture, aroma, etc., get translated into an integrated network of connected neurons that fire together. These firings, or electrochemical impulses, are not concentrated in one section of the brain. There is no apple section. The apple information is spread out in a vastly complicated network. In one experiment, a cat was taught to find food behind a door that was marked with a specific geometric shape. That one geometric form set off learning-related responses in over 5 million cells distributed throughout the cat's brain. In another experiment, the ability to distinguish the sound of P from the sound of B was represented in 22 sites scattered across the human brain. When Harold saw a dog, a network of neurons fired. The more he saw a dog, the denser and more efficient the connections between the appropriate neurons grew. The more you see dogs, the faster and more complex your dog networks become, and the better you are at perceiving the general qualities of dogness and the differences between dogs. With effort, practice, and experience, you can improve the subtlety of your networks. Violinists have dense connections in the area of the brain related to their left hand because they use it so much while playing their instrument. You have a distinctive signature, a distinctive smile, and a distinctive way of drying yourself off after a shower because you perform these activities a lot, and the corresponding networks of neurons are thus thickly connected in your brain. You can probably recite the alphabet from A to Z, because through repetition you have built that sequence of patterns in your head. You would probably have trouble reciting the alphabet from Z to A, because that sequence has not been reinforced by experience. In this way, each of us has unique neural networks, which are formed, reinforced, and constantly updated by the eclectic circumstances of our lives. Once circuits are formed, that increases the chances the same circuits will fire in the future. The neural networks embody our experiences and in turn guide future action. They contain the unique way each of us carries himself in the world, the way we walk, talk, and react. They are the grooves down which our behavior flows. A brain is the record of a life. The networks of neural connections are the physical manifestation of your habits, personality, and predilections. You are the spiritual entity that emerges out of the material networks in your head.